tremendous. Thank you so much for giving me a chance to open this season's seminar series in quantum gravity. Okay, great to be here. So I want to tell you something about my recent paper with Chris Houston, two of our undergrads, Edmund W. Heath and Nick Wood, who are now already doing a PhD, but unfortunately not in causal sets. But this can still change. Okay, so first of all, I want to tell you something about the framework I work in, algebraic quantum field theory, and then focus on the example of construction on causal sets. All right, so what is algebraic quantum field theory for those of you who don't know? So first of all, it's a framework to study conceptual problems in QFT in sort of, you know, rigorous mathematical way. So it started as an idea of Hagen-Kassler, and the basic principle, and I think I would switch to this. So the basic principle is that you characterize a system by assigning to bounded regions of Minkowski spacetime. So this was all started in Minkowski spacetime situation, algebras of what they called observables, but you might want to think of those as operations that you can perform or measure in that region. Okay, so to a region, we assign an algebra. And then if we have an inclusion of regions, then we have inclusion of algebras. Okay, so this is the basic structure. So this was the basic motivation. And you can also generalize it to curved spacetime. People realize it doesn't really matter to be on Minkowski. So you can assign algebras to regions of some arbitrary Lorentzian manifold. And okay, so what's the advantage or what's the main feature here is that the construction of the algebras is somewhat separated from the construction of the state. So you probably know that on curved spacetime we don't have a unique vacuum, so having these two problems sort of separated might be an advantage. All right? Okay, so the corresponding generalization of a QFT is called locally covariant quantum field theory. So there are many names attached to it, so I'm just listing a few. So there was a seminal work of Hollands and Wald and Brunetti, Frame, Hagen, Feisch, which started this whole business. Then there were later works by Fuster and Feisch, kind of expanding on this idea, and many, many more. So sorry for not being able to write the whole list here. And then for a concrete construction, if you want to construct physically interesting theories, like, I don't know, standard model, you might need some perturbation methods. So this is what perturbative AQFT, short PAQFT, is all about. And the first step was made already in the 70s by two gentlemen, Epstein and Glaser, who kind of thought about a good way to do randomization in a mathematically rigorous way. So this was the first building block. Then for a long time, there was nothing. And then this was again picked up in 2000s by Dutch, Van Hagen, and Brunetti in various combinations, who kind of revived that whole approach, combined it with this idea of doing things on curved spacetime, and then a lot of output followed. So many models were constructed. The generalization to gauge theories was due to Hollands in 2008, and the generalization to, well, everything with local symmetries was my work with Van Hagen, 2011. So at this point, I think we can say that we have a fairly good understanding how this toolbox works if we want to construct models on curved spacetime. Now, okay, so here's, if you want to read more about it, there is a book. Now, the question is it really important that we have a smooth manifold? And the answer is, well, not entirely. So in fact, you can drop this smooth manifold idea and take, for example, a discrete set of points. What you need to keep is some sort of causality relation. So a very important ingredient of the whole construction is causality. So the only thing you need actually here from your base spacetime manifold is the information about causal order. So let's ditch the manifold. Let's just preserve some sort of causal order relation. and let's work with just a discrete set of points. So this was the idea, which was generated after one of my visits here in Yai. So since I thought it was an interesting thing to try, I started working on this with Chris Huster and a couple of students. And recently, we finally came to a conclusion. So there is a paper on the archive that you can have a look at. And the rest of this talk, I will try to give you an overview of what's in that paper and what's the framework about. Okay, so I think that the large proportion, if not everyone here, knows what a causal set is, but let me just remind you. So we have C, a discrete set of points, and there is the partial order relation. So here I use the convention less than equal for this causal order relation. So we have to have some sort of transitivity, a cyclicity, and important one, local finiteness. And here by this I of xy, I mean the causal interval, so the Alexandrov set. So this is the set of all points which are larger equal x, less than equal y. And if I write this relation without the equal, then I mean that it's large or equal, but the equality does not hold. So this is just intuitive way of organizing the notation. Okay, so this is going to be the base structure on which I'm going to construct things. I will focus on the scalar field theory. I know there is some ongoing work on generalizing it to other fun things, but for the moment, we understand the scalar fields. So let's start with that. Good thing about it is that now we understand not only the free scalar field, which is kind of boring, although, okay, there is a lot to be done there as well, but we can also do arbitrary interactions. So I think that's maybe the interesting point about this whole discussion. Okay, so let's start with some physical input. So what I need to get my machinery going. So I start with a fixed causal set. Again, this is just the first step in the larger program, because in the end, we want to understand also how these things evolve. So there is some ongoing work of Faye and other people here. But for the moment, I want this fixed. And on this, I want to consider the space of field configurations. And for the moment, I'm working off shell. So what are the field configurations? This is, again, an analog of the scalar field on a manifold. So a configuration would be a map, phi, from causal set to real number. So we have a real number assigned to each point. Okay, so for a finite causal set with n elements, this is just Rn. So we have an element of R at each point. So these are just vectors, very nice things. Okay, so now observables are rather operations. So these are going to be, sorry, I think there is something in the way. So these are going to be all smooth functions on the configuration space. So classically, I think of an observable as some way to attach a number to a configuration. So you can think of this number as a result of a measurement. I could stay in R, so I wrote it C, because for the quantum theory, I will need to go into the complex valued functions. So let's do it already at this level. Okay, so this was all kinematics, right? And now I want some sort of dynamical law. And here I do it in two steps. So first of all, I want free dynamics. And here, okay, what do I need? What I actually need for the construction is the some sort of discretized retarded Green function. So this is very similar to Raphael's approach, where this is the starting point for the construction. Ideally, this should come from some natural way of discretizing a normally hyperbolic operator, so like a wave operator, D'Alembertian on in the continuum, and then so there should be some way in which this discretized green function is an inverse of some discretized wave operator. So that's the conceptual part of things. Okay, and now the interaction. So the interaction is treated slightly differently. So I have the free theory, and now I consider a perturbation of that with an interacting term, and I'm going to think in terms of some modification of Lagrangian format. So two things maybe to note. First of all, this is a fully covariant version of things. So there is a version of that formalism where one works on a globally hyperbolic spacetime. So there, by fully covariant, I mean that one doesn't need an explicit foliation into Cauchy surfaces. So you don't need to kind of split between time and space in your theory. Yes, yes, please.
If you have a discrete space-time,
yes.
Don't you lose the Ritz
invariance? Oh, I'm not talking about Lorentz invariance here. I'm just saying fully covariant in a sense that in the continuum, there is no preferred time direction. So that's why it can be generalized to the discrete situation where choosing a time direction would be unnatural. So there is no, there has nothing to do with Lorentz invariance. Because, good point, in the discrete that wouldn't. I mean, even in, of course, in curved spacetime, that also wouldn't make sense in general. But this framework avoids that problem entirely. Okay, so what, yeah, so the choice of interaction is then a choice of some functional, some observable from my set of observables. Okay, so that's the input. So now what do we do with it? So let me start slowly with maybe a few words about green functions and how this framework works in the continuum, because this might be more familiar. So I start with a globally hyperbolic spacetime. So it means that it has a Cauchy surface. We like spacetimes with Cauchy surfaces. And this space of configurations is now smooth functions on M. So analogy to what I said before, the free equations of motion are just given by the Klein-Gordon operator. So box plus M squared, the standard thing. And now, okay, so if my spacetime was nice and globally hyperbolic, then I know about the existence of retarded and advanced Green functions, which I denote here by E plus and E minus. So what's special about them is their support properties. So if I have some test function F and I act on it with the retarded Green function E plus, then the result has support extended to the future of the support of F. So that's this situation here. And if I do that with the advanced Green function, then the support is extended to the past. Okay, and both of these guys are, of course, Green functions, so they are inverses of the field equations operator P. Okay, so this is the situation in the continuum. And now the difference between these two guys, E plus minus E minus, is the Pauli-Jordan operator, also a Pauli-Jordan function in the literature. Okay, so this is the guy I want to get. So I want to have the analogy of that story now on the causal set. So let me first give you some sort of wish list of what I want to obtain from that. So I will focus on finite causal sets so that things converge nicely and I can work with matrices, which is so much easier than working with operators. So I want to study equations of the following form. So phi is my field configuration. F plays the role of a source. And now I have these two n by n matrices, P and K, which play a role of, well, P is the discretized wave operator, and K, oops, so K is kind of some, first of all, additional freedom to add some coefficients on the right-hand side, and second of all, well, there could be different ways I discretize the source. So here, again, if I think of trying to discretize the wave equation with a source, there is freedom in how I discretize the wave operator, but there is also some freedom in how I discretize the source, because I could take the value at a point, I can take the average between neighboring points, and so on. So this is all encoded in this extra operator K. Okay, so now we have to make some choices. And I said I want to focus on constructing the retarded green function. So this operator P is also sort of retarded type operator. So it has to take the, so in order to get the value of P of phi at a given point, it refers to the values of phi in the past. Okay, so it propagates the initial data from past to future. And this is very similar to what has been done in the causal set literature. So we require P to be retarded operator. So as I said, the combination of Qs, phi Qs, such that Q is in the past. And also for consistency, K should also be a retarded operator. OK, they both should be real. We want real equations of motion. And if I choose the natural labeling of the causal set, so I want to label the points by integers. So with this, P is a lower triangular matrix. Its entries on the diagonal are non-vanishing. So P is invertible, which is nice because, you know, the whole business was about inverting it. So far, so good. So I can, so given any equation of this sort, I can now define my retarded green operator as inverse of P composed with K. So this is the kind of structure I want to look at. Now you can ask the question, all right, so how does this look in practice? Before I get to that, okay, so we have E plus. The retarded green operator is the transpose of that. Sorry, the advanced green operator is the transpose of that. So then it propagates data to the past. So if that one was a lower triangular, this is going to be upper triangular. And the Pauli-Jordan operator is, again, the difference between the two. So this bit is exactly the same as in the continuum. Okay, and now as an example of P, which has these properties and has a good interpretation in terms of continuum limit, there is a proposal by Raphael of an operator with the following set of weights. You can, and there are results concerning how this operator approximates the continuum guy. So here this number n is the size of the Alexandrov set minus one. So this is the size, so this is number of points in the Alexandrov set minus the let's say the top point. Okay, so this is one answer. There are also other possibilities. So we looked into other ways to think about discretizing the wave operator. We have another proposal in the paper, which however uses some extra structure, which is maybe suboptimal, but has other good properties. I think it's still maybe an interesting thing to ponder upon what's the right or convenient way to discretize the wave operator and what are various properties of those. But the good thing for me at this point is that there are proposals, there are working models, so we can just go ahead and use them. All right. How do we use them? So as I said, let me just come back here briefly. An important guy here is this Pauli-Jordan operator. So this is difference between the retarded and advanced Green function. And okay, what do I use it for? Well, so here, this is a formula which is a direct analog of the Pius construction for the continuum. So this is an old work, actually. I don't remember what year exactly, but it predates this whole business by a lot. So Pius was thinking about the problem, how do I construct some analog, or some version of canonical bracket, which is covariant. And his idea was remarkable, that you have to look at something which he called retarded response and advanced response. So you look at your solutions to a given theory with a given Lagrangian, and then you perturb this Lagrangian by some local operator, and then you look how these solutions change. And essentially using that philosophy, he derived the formula for a bracket in terms of retarded and advanced Green functions. And this bracket is a Poisson bracket, has all the nice properties, and also is equivalent to the canonical bracket you get in Hamiltonian mechanics, as long as you know the Hamiltonian picture exists. And here is the formula. So what do? You take variations of your two observables, of your two functionals, and then contract those with the Pauli-Jordan function. Here we are in finite dimensions, so this notation with variational derivatives is a bit an overkill, because these phis are just n vectors, so you can also write it in the more suggestive notation. This is the I derivative, this is the J derivative, or if you're upset with indices, this is the index-free version of that. So E is a matrix, this is a vector, this is a vector, so this all works. There is some convention, there is some choice which is kind of hidden in that formula, which maybe doesn't strike you immediately. So the natural way to think about all these operators, and well, including E itself, is as things with one lower index, one upper index, because they act on vectors, give you vectors. So if you're slightly more careful about your choices, then you realize that somehow implicitly we are using the Euclidean inner product here to raise the indices, so to identify a vector space with its dual. This is absolutely harmless in a finite dimensional situation, so one can happily ignore it. However, when we then pass to the continuum picture, this is not such a harmless step. So this actually corresponds to the choice of integration measure on your manifold, and this choice can affect things. So word of caution. But here, okay, there is a very natural choice to work with. Okay, and so in our paper, we have shown that this formula gives you a Poisson bracket as expected, and this agrees with this idea of Pius that the bracket should be the difference between retarded and advanced response. So it has the same physical interpretation as the Pius bracket as defined by Pius, which is also encouraging. Okay, so that's essentially covers the sourceless situation for constructing the free dynamics. Now I want to say something about a little subtlety with edge effects. So if we are working with a finite causal set, then there is you know, some point where we run out of causal sets. So there is a point with no future, and there are points with no past. So how do we deal with those? If you think of continuum situation, you wouldn't encounter that, because this would be either in future infinity or past infinity, so you don't bother. However, in the discretized version of things, this can lead to some trouble. Okay, so let me introduce some notation so that I can make things more precise. So again, I'm following the definitions from a paper of Raphael. So here I define layers. So given the point X, I can look at the points Y of its past such that the size of the Alexandrov set is of some fixed value. So, okay, so let's see. We have here X, and then we can consider, it's a always logistic problem with the lights, right? So let's do it like this. Okay. So let's look at maybe first this example. So the first layer, the first past layer in this would be the set of points Y in the past of X, such that the size of the Alexandrov set is 2, so I plus 1. Okay, so here this would be this, this, and that. So the Alexandrov set of size 2 would include this point and this point, this point and this point, this point and this point. So this is the first, so this is L1 minus of X. And now the next layer, L2 minus, so then the size of the Alexandrov set would have to be 3. Let's see if we have them. Well, this is 1, 2, 3. Okay, so for example, this one, this is 1, 2, 3. Okay, so actually I missed L2. So these both will have the size of Alexandrov set 4, so n is 3. So these two points belong to L3 minus. If I want, something else, and maybe draw an extra. So this one is 1, 2, 3. So this one is L2 minus X. Okay, so this is the sort of layering with respect to a given point.
So can the point
yes.
be two
layers? No, because, with respect to a given point, right? I mean, of course, so this is in the L1 minus of X, right? But this point could be in a different layer with respect to a different point.
Right, okay. Yeah. That point in the bottom left, isn't it 1 and 2?
No, it's the size of the Alexandrov set. So these are all points which are causally related. So you count all of them. So here the size of the Alexandrov set is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, okay.
So this is not the, so this would be the notion of a rank, would be related to the minimal path. But layer takes all the points in between. Okay. So there is the one with plus, that's obvious, right? Yes?
Your numbering is nxy minus 1 equals r.
Yeah, so this is the Alexandrov set minus 1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you defined n to be that.
To be Alexandrov set size minus 1, yeah. Because that's,
yeah.
That's just convenience choice. Okay, so why is it important for what I want to say? So I want to introduce the notion of n-layer past infinity. So this is the set of points that have an empty layer of a number given than the fixed one. So For example, okay, so what is the one layer past infinity? One layer past infinity is all the points who don't have a past. So on this picture, okay, so these two guys don't have a past, and this guy doesn't have a past. So they all would belong to C minus one. Okay, now C minus two would be points who do not have so this is points that don't have the first layer. C2 minus would be the points that have nobody in the second layer, and so on. So you're kind of thickening this slice of the past by adding more and more layers. And clearly, this what happens in this n-layer past is sort of an edge effect. So your discretized Dielem version would behave differently for these points. Okay, so there's the same thing with the future infinity. I can define projections to these sets. And now here's the thing. So if I want to include the effects of this past and future infinity, then I have to add an extra term to my equation apart from the source term, which takes care of the values of the field in the far past. So you can think of the values of the field in the past infinity as a sort of like initial condition. So you can think of this as an analog of a Cauchy surface or a thickened Cauchy surface, and then this values of the field at past infinity is some analog of the Cauchy data. Okay, and the particular situation of interest is that if there is no source, so the only thing on the right-hand side is the value of these Cauchy data, and then the solution is just given by applying the Green function on the Cauchy data.
Sorry,
okay, yes,
you,
yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is this phi minus restriction of phi to the...
Oh, it's the projection. So you see, I kill... Oh, yeah, okay, it's the same. Yeah, yeah, it's just the restriction. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, in the sense of that you set the values everywhere else at zero, right? So this is a field that kind of lives on the whole causal set but vanishes everywhere but on this past slice.
So it's only on the absolute minimum elements that
yeah.
It's not zero.
Yeah. So it kind of so what you want to work with here, what sort of size of the past infinity depends on how many layers your discretized Dielem version has. So for example, let me go back to this one. So this guy needs three layers. So it behaves differently for guys which don't have the first, second, or the third layer. So the natural size of past infinity for this guy is three layers, because there is a different behavior for those. So I want to treat them in a sense separately so that the discretization does the correct thing sort of in the middle, far away from the boundary.
So what you call past infinity is a certain number of layers
yeah.
coming from the bottom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Depending on what the Dielem-Barrett.
Yeah, so exactly. So then I correct by hand what happens in these layers by adding that extra term. Okay? And then I can work also in the sourceless situation. And then I have obviously non-zero solution. Otherwise, if I wouldn't correct for that and work in the sourceless situation, then the solution would vanish everywhere, which would be very suboptimal. All right, so now I'm actually very interested in this whole Cauchy situation, because in the continuum we have the notion of a Cauchy evolution. And we wanted to see if there is something like a Cauchy evolution happening on causal sets, which are nice enough. Okay, so clearly if they are super crazy, then that's not possible. But is there a notion of niceness which allows for this notion to happen? And it turns out there is. So first of all, okay, so we focus on this situation with no sources, and the solution space is obtained. Essentially, you take the space of the Cauchy data, which is configurations which are just restricted to that past slice, and then you allow your retarded Green function to act on it. So this is exactly the solution space for that situation. This is still working great. Okay, so this, what does it do? So this essentially puts in bijection the space of solutions and the space of the Cauchy data in the far past. Now, if we are super lucky, then we also have a bijection with the data on far future, on the future. So this is the first assumption I want to make. Let's look at causal sets where this can fly. Okay, so then we can have a map from the past infinity to future infinity, so from configurations at past infinity to configurations at future infinity, which we call Cauchy evolution, which is given by applying this retarded Green function and then restricting. So you restrict on one side, apply Green function, and restrict again by applying this projector. Okay. Now, the first non-trivial requirement is that this future and past infinity have to have the same cardinality. So obviously, this is not always the case. So this can only work if they do. But if we have this, we can be tempted to compare the dynamics on two causal sets which only differ by some small perturbations somewhere in the middle. So we consider two causal sets such that their future and past infinities can be identified. This is also some extra assumption. And they differ only by something in the middle. So think about small perturbation. And then we define the map, which we call relative Cauchy evolution, which goes all the way around. So we start with the past data, then propagate to the future in one causal set, identify the futures with the other, and propagate back to the past. So this kind of measures the influence on the dynamics by perturbing my causal set in the middle. Why is that interesting at all? Well, we have a similar situation happening in the continuum where this actually characterizes the dynamics almost entirely. So by giving this sort of evolution map, one can reconstruct the stress energy tensor of the theory. So there is a lot you can learn just from that. So let me just draw a quick picture. So,
yes.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, so here is, so this is now continuum picture. So here is one space-time, here is another space-time. So M and M tilde, which have the identification between these, well, all these Cauchy slices. So these are some neighborhoods of Cauchy surfaces in the continuum, and they differ by a perturbation of the metric somewhere away from those Cauchy slices. Okay, and then you can look at the evolution, which goes all the way around here. So you evolve to the future, identify, evolve to the past, identify, and see the difference. So we hope that, well, we have constructed the analog of that map for causal sets, so one can maybe study the dynamics using that prescription. study the stability under perturbations. Okay, where is the thing? Splendid. Okay, so that's kind of finishes the free theory story, which, okay, it always takes a lot of time. Let's do something very interesting. So let's put an interaction into the game. And again, I'm, that's not stable. Okay, so let's work with the finite puzzle set. So this will stop working eventually, right? So I have this feeling. Okay, so let's try to perturb our dynamics by some interaction term. So we have a coupling constant lambda. We have some interaction term V. And let's see what happens. Okay, first of all, just to avoid any second thoughts about non-converging series, let's work with formal power series, and then maybe we can get away with things later on. So, yeah. So how does this look on the level of equations of motion? We know the three equations of motion are given in terms of this P phi. Let's assume there are no sources, so there is just this past Cauchy data that we need to worry about. So the effect of this perturbation is fully characterized by adding the variation of the interaction to the equations of motion. That's classical mechanics. Okay, now we can also linearize these equations of motion around a fixed configuration. This is what you also do sometimes. And then for that, we need the second derivative of this interaction term, which is, again, an n by n matrices. And this can be very nonlinear. This can be absolutely crazy function. Just, you know, you want this to be differentiable. Otherwise, these derivatives don't make sense. But any smooth function would do. Okay, and yeah, so these are your linearized equations of motion for a given background. All right, so immediately we can write the interacting Poisson bracket. This is, yes?
So when you say V1,
yes.
Am I think of that as partial V, partial lambda?
Which one? This one,
yes.
Yeah. This is partial v partial phi. This is, yeah. So v one.
Oh, it's the first derivative.
Yeah.
It's the gradient.
Yeah. So this is over d phi. And okay. So maybe I should add a point, right? So if it's something very nonlinear, then it will differ from point to point. And this has components which are given by dv over d phi I. So these are n. So this is an n vector. So this guy is an n vector. This guy, when you take the second derivative, it has two indices flying loose. So this is an n by n matrix. And if you have more derivatives hitting a functional, then you would have higher tensors. So this will happen soon. Does it make sense?
So what is psi? Yeah.
Oh, so this is the linearization, right? So here are two things. So I'm linearizing around the point. So I'm feeding that point in. This has two loose indices, so this is a 2x2 matrix. And then I apply it on a vector because it's a directional derivative. So now I apply it on a vector. So you think of it as linearizing your equations of motion around a fixed configuration. So phi is a fixed configuration, and psi is now the argument. So psi would be a solution of these linearized equations of motion for a fixed phi.
Psi is like the first variation or the first correction to
Yeah. So psi you can think of as living in the tangent of the solution space. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now the formula for the bracket. In a sense, it's really straightforward. So you use the same idea of Pius bracket, but instead of the original free Pauli-Jordan function, you take the interacting Pauli-Jordan function. And this, again, is not difficult to get. You construct it from the free one by using the Neumann series. So this is the standard way how you construct the green function of the interacting equations, knowing the free one. There are also other nice gadgets. So there is the retarded classical Miller map, so a map which takes a solution to the free equations of motion and spits out the solution to the interacting ones. Again, this is direct analogy to the classical mechanics situation. Okay, and here we can also pull back by this map on the solutions and get the map on the observables. And there is a cute little identity that this interacting bracket is giving is equal to the twist of the free bracket by that Miller map. So everything works the way you would like it to work. So there is a map which intertwines between free and interacting solutions. There is the free and interacting bracket. So there is a way to nicely introduce the interacting dynamics. Okay, so that's the classical theory. Any questions up to now? There were some questions already. Yes.
So in this, you should use fixed phi naught or something about which you're
This is not linearized, actually. This is the full guy. This is the full interacting
the
theory.
Full
Yeah.
But the definition of these operators, doesn't it depend on the choice of the phi you started with?
So this is, no, not really. So this is a map that acts on a phi, which is a solution. It's a nonlinear map.
Yes.
It takes, so you see, that it's a bit of an implicit game going on here. So this map appears on both sides of this equation. So it's not so easy to kind of extract it out from here. So let's see. If you now apply P on both sides, right, then you have, so you have P applied here, you have P acting on E plus, there is a minus sign going on, which I keep on neglecting, so P on E plus gives you minus the identity. So P intertwined with this map on the right-hand side would give you exactly the interacting equations of motion. So the full interacting equations of motion have V1 rather than the linearization. So this is an exercise to check that this actually gives you the intertwining map. Now, it's less trivial to actually extract the explicit formula for that map out of this equation. So this is like Young-Feldman equation. But this has been done, so we have even non-perturbative formula for this map, which, so one has to know something. So knowing if you have non-perturbative formula for the interacting green function, then you can have, non-perturbative formula for this Miller map.
So this is the operator, little r, lambda, b.
Yeah.
Shouldn't there be some sort of boundary condition? I mean,
this is a
interacting.
Absolutely. So
there's no God-given way of mapping.
Yeah. So this is identifying the past boundary data. So this is the equations. So this is a solution to the interacting problem, provided it agrees with the solution to the free problem in the far pass. So they both have the same pass boundary data. That's why it works, yeah. Otherwise, yeah, good point. Alrighty, so quantization. Again, everybody has their favorite. I have my favorite. My favorite is deformation quantization. So if you're not yet into it, then, well, okay, I'll try to convince you, but it's hopeless in 5 minutes. All right, so what is it about? I like my observables. I like my functionals. I don't want to do anything terrible to them, but I don't necessarily like my product. So the natural product to introduce on the space of functions is just a pointwise product of multiplying functions. But this is a terrible product if you want to, you know, do quantum mechanics with those. It's very commutative, right? So what I'm looking for is a non-commutative product, which I would have reasons to call the quantum product of the theory. But I want to keep my observables the same. So I have the same vector space of functions as I had in the classical theory, but I'm looking for nice, good products. And here is one, which has names Moyal and Weil attached to it. It's an exponential type product, so you have sort of operator where you differentiate things and contract with a given kernel, or in the finite dimensional case, you contract with a given n by n matrix. So all these things are very simple algebraic operations. So one way is to take your Pauli-Jordan function and construct this product by exponentiating it. Now, let me just see. I have the right example. Let me just quickly justify why this is a good idea before I go any further. So let's go back to the continuum case where maybe things are easier to follow and take two linear observables, which are just smeared fields, classical. This is classical observables. So here is, one test function. Here is another test function. Everything lives on some fixed globally hyperbolic manifold. And then, I've changed the notation in the middle. Sorry. I would be very grateful if I could convince all my collaborators to use the same notation. But this never happened. So each of my papers denotes things exactly differently. Okay, so this delta here, this is E. Okay, sorry for that. So the commutator of the two smeared fields, if you use this formula for the product, is actually given in terms of the Pauli-Jordan function. Good, let's see if I've... No, I didn't fix it. And on Minkowski spacetime, from the properties of this Pauli-Jordan function, you actually recover the equal time commutation relations. So the motivation for using that particular prescription for the star product is that you recover the correct commutation relation. So this is all you're after, really. So this is just a way to construct your algebra in a very clean state independent way. So no Fock space yet. All right. So, but there are other products. There are many other products. So you can stick various things into this contraction operator. So in particular, you can modify your guy Pauli-Jordan function with something symmetric. And the end result has the interpretation of a two-point function of a quasi-free state. So A is that algebra we constructed using the Pauli-Jordan function as the input. Okay, so you get a different product. There are some properties for this W which are required if you want to think of it as a two-point function of a state. Okay, so first of all, well, this is some sort of reality condition. So E should be the imaginary part, H should be real. Very important one, W has to be positive definite, or positive semi-definite, actually. Why? Well, because state, right? States have to be positive functionals on your algebra. So the two-point function has to be positive definite. And OK, so this is some sort of proxy for equations of motion. The kernel of this matrix should have something to do with the kernel of your Pauli-Oden operator. So these are sort of minimal requirements for W, which is reasonable as an analog of a two-point function. OK, now what's this magic of going from one product to the other? Well, this is a known magic, actually. This corresponds to normal ordering. So this is, again, exercise for the audience. You can check that these two products are equivalent. And this equivalent on the level of observables would amount to normal ordering with respect to this given two-point function. So you can think of this as an algebraic way of implementing normal ordering, still without having to talk about creation annihilation operators explicitly. Haven't done that yet. OK, and this connects nicely to Sorokin-Johnson axioms as well. So if we want to have some distinguished W, then we can ask for a bit more. So here, the axioms by Sorokin and Johnson, which are very similar to those I gave you. So the first one is this reality condition, so that the antisymmetric part, the imaginary part, is given by the Pauli-Oden function. So this gives you the right commutation relations. There is the positivity, the way you want it. And there is an extra, which makes this an analog of the vacuum. So the idea here of a Sorokin-Johnson state is that it is an analog of the vacuum. So there is a ground state condition, which then distinguish a particular W among all the others. So that's what we're going to do. And here is a particular solution for that W if you start with these axioms. So here is the formula. And note that you can use a unique square root here because you have a positive semi-definite matrix to square root it. OK, I think I'm running out of time. Is that correct? OK. So this is the connection, right? So we kind of made the full circle. So we have this algebraic way of constructing the algebra of observables, first in the free theory. And then by making particular choices, we can connect this to how things are usually done in the causal set theory. But I just want to point out that in our framework, there's this extra freedom of considering other states than a Sorokin-Johnson state by allowing more freedom to choose that W. OK, so now this is maybe secondary. Let me just say a few words about how to do the interaction. So if you have fixed your state, so you fix the symmetric part of the two-point function, you can construct the analog of the Feynman propagator. And with that, you can construct a lot of very cool gadgets, which we use in quantum field theory in the continuum. And they work even better in quantum field theory and causal sets because everything actually converges. All right. So we have the time ordering map, which is, again, this is connection to what's known. So this is an analog of taking the path integral, so convolution with the Gaussian measure. So this is yet another way of realizing the path integral in the algebraic way. So I hope to be able to say something more about it in the future. There is the time-ordered product. So everything is written in terms of matrices. We have the formal S matrix, which is the time-ordered exponential. And last but not least, we have an explicit formula for the interacting fields. So forgetting about all the technicalities of the construction, let's focus on what's actually important here. So we take as an input the free theory, which is given in terms of some discretization of the Green function. We choose a perturbation V, so the interaction term, and we choose an observable F that we want to study. Okay, we turn the crank, and then this is the formula for the interacting observable, for the interacting field corresponding to F in that theory with interaction V. And this is very explicit. Maybe that formula is not very beautiful, but we have better, more practical formulae in terms of expansion into finitely many Feynman diagrams. So this is perfectly well computable and yeah, can be done with a finitely many grad students. This yet has to be tested. So we can also use this to construct the interacting product. And most importantly, we can construct the interacting correlation functions of fields using the same prescription. So, for all the technical fun, please refer to our paper. And because I'm running out of time, and this is probably going to explode in a minute, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. I think we have time for one or two more quick questions.
Just a little question. Near the beginning, you generalized the idea of the source to be KF instead of.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Do you have a specific choice for K?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So
in the paper, we look at three choices on the diamond lattice. So we kind of played with it because we had too much time and two undergrads. Okay, so you can take you can take a value at a point, right? P, you can take some sort of average between four points. And another one we tried was in the sort of trapezoid rule. So you take these points, but with different weights. So there are three choices which we try. And this is really funny because that gives you slightly different formulae for these Green functions. So it gives slightly different continuum limit. So on average, that shouldn't matter. But I think, it might be interesting to see how much it doesn't matter exactly.
Also, can you repeat the main or the most important? You've got explicit forms for the interacting operators.
Yes, and the correlation functions.
Does it mean you have, like, so for each element of the causal set X, there could be an operator phi hat of X or whatever you want to call it. The field operator.
Well, yeah, so there are like two layers, right? So there's the points of the causal sets, there are the field configurations, right? Which are the solutions, and there are observables, which are maps from the solution space to complex, right? So you can think of localizing your operators at a point. But you don't have to.
You could,
yeah. If yeah, sure.
And this would give you phi, let's call it phi hat, I don't know what to call it, but the quantum operator would give you phi hat of x for every x
the evaluation of observable would be that, right?
Yeah. So let's say, so we have point X, and a simple example, or maybe I should use that word, right? That would be more user-friendly. So here is a simple example. So we have a point X of a causal set, and we take evaluation at X. So this acting on phi, so phi is in Rn, this has more points, right? So this gives phi of x, right? And then now, so this is for, I would say, the free theory. And now I throw it into my machinery, and I have this guy, which is now the interacting operator at point x. So this is the interacting, I would call it phi, interacting at x. This interacting field localized at x. But you can localize things across several points, or really however you want it. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you've done something much more general. You've allowed any function on
phi. Well, I. So this can be any smooth function, in fact. Yeah. And so can this one, because it doesn't really matter. You just need to be able to for a finite causal set, right? If you have the infinitely many points, then you might worry about some convergence of things. But for a finite causal set, you can throw it.
You get a finite number.
Do you have a question as well? Sorry.
And then we can degenerate into more discussion.
Okay, so is the input the discrete p from which you derive the discrete e plus? Is that right? So
yes.
Is that discrete? What conditions are there on the discrete p? I mean, I ask because you're not at, because you're working on the causal set and you're not considering Lorentz invariants or anything like that. I mean, for example, if you mention the diamond lattice, so take the diamond lattice, there's a discrete p, which is the simple one, which, you know, if you have your 4 point, then, you know, box phi at the top point is just the sum of the bottom minus the Would that be an example of a p that's allowed in your?
That's another example. Actually, this is a particular example we also look at.
Okay. So that
yeah. So in the paper we consider the ansatz by Raphael, and we also consider an ansatz with this preferred past. So for each causal set point, you need some sort of preferred point in the past, which is kind of obvious in the diamond lattice because this is the point directly under. And we have a formula for the discretized D'Alembertian with these two inputs.
So that P, the diamond lattice P, is part of the other form that you had with
it. It just needs this extra input of preferred past. Because it also, it also picks things up from, right? So you have to, So you have to distinguish some point in the past, and then you take all the points between this point and your reference point. But they are all in the past, right? So this is a sort of retarded type operator. So that's the only important thing. You can take many points with many weights. You can use layer, rank, whatever, as long as this only depends on the data in the past. So the one on the diamond lattice is also an example.
Yeah, and then this picture on the right there, how common is it that this works in the sense that your condition that there's an isomorphism between your solutions and Cauchy data on the top Cauchy thingy?
I think, I would say you
do this.
Yeah.
You can do this complete this circle?
I think you have to rig it a bit. So I would say you take one which you already know, right? You take one fixed causal set, and then you perturb it away from future and past infinity, right? So this is made for the situation where you study perturbations of a fixed causal set. I mean, yeah, so I think, okay. If you're asking how common it is for to find a perturbation of a given causal set, right, randomly.
I just want to know about one of those diagrams.
Oh, about one. So that this is the same as that.
The only condition you listed was that the cardinalities of the bottom
yeah.
bit. And the
yeah.
Top bit.
But I think you would have
the other conditions about the structure of the causal set in the middle.
We can talk about it, but I think okay. Mathematically, I don't think so. Physically, you might end up with something really weird. Because you might.
All collapses.
Yeah, all collapses. Yeah. So the mathematics doesn't see it, but then it has kind of weird physical interpretation. So, yeah, I think. Okay. I think one could ask for more things in terms of, like, maybe there existing a Cauchy slicing or things like that. If you want to have some sort of preservation of the information while it propagates, right? Some sort of predictability. So I think, yeah, then you want to ask for more. So physics would ask for more than just mathematics. I think that's the simple answer.
Okay, one final question.
So what kind of new effects do you expect from this holism in comparison to ordinary QFT?
New effects? I don't know. depends what you are after, because in a sense, doing things in a discrete situation has some effects which are particular to the discrete situation. But I wouldn't say, yeah, your question is probably what do we learn about quantum gravity or discrete structure of space-time by doing that? Is that your question? Or so what's the physical consequences of there being a discrete causal?
Say for your S matrix, would you see something new?
So first of all, so if you want to reproduce your S matrix in the continuum, you have to have some procedure of going from the discrete to the continuum. So I guess part of the question would be a question to Raphael and Faye, because you guys have studied this more and physical consequences of that. But I think one has to maybe commit to some sort of interpretation of how you go from discrete to the continuum. And one of the ways is taking a sprinkling and average over sprinkling. We haven't done it for the S matrix in that particular setting. I don't know what's the state of the art in other approaches, but that would be something to try and then see if we can actually see new effects.
Let's
people go.
Here for, I think, 2 more weeks.
Yes, but I will return.
Okay, that's okay.